Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and you've probably heard that old saying, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. Well, funny story. Turns out, most of us don't know history, or at least the history of that quote, and are doomed to repeating kinda sorta weird versions of it. See, what George Santayana actually wrote was, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. But that was over 100 years ago, and we've been unable to remember it. The reason I mention this is that in music, people who do know history often find themselves repeating it, and we're fine with that. Like the UK band Savages, these four young women have absorbed the early history of punk and especially of post-punk music and have become one of the hottest acts in England. They'll play live for us in just a bit. And we'll look at a fascinating collection of old recordings that captured a moment in Native American history, but have unexpectedly reached into the present. But if you want to talk about music history, let's talk about the Rolling Stones. They've been recording for 50 years. Think of it, half a century. The Rolling Stones have been around for almost half of the entire history of recorded music. How do you possibly begin to talk about that? Well, here's a good way to start. You gotta tell me you're coming back to me. You gotta tell me you're coming back to me. You gotta tell me you're coming back to me. You gotta tell me you're coming back to me. You. Tell Me was the Rolling Stones' first hit single that they wrote themselves. It is also the first song covered in a new book called Rocks Off, 50 tracks that tell the story of the Rolling Stones. The author is Bill Janovitz, who's had a long history with music himself, as a writer, but also as a founding member of the group Buffalo Tom. Bill wrote 50 essays, each about a different Stone song, and he joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. Hey, Bill.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. At what point did you say to yourself in this project, my God, what have I done?
Well, when the idea was at first brought to me, hey, do you want to write another book about the Rolling Stones? Because I wrote one on the subject of Exile on Main Street for the 33 and a Third series. Mm-hmm. I said, I don't want to write another one, basically. I mean, first of all, the story's been told a million times before, but then it was presented to me. It was like, well, what about if you're doing 50 tracks for the 50 years? And I said, well, that's an interesting hook, and I really would like to write about the music. I'm not really interested in writing yet another history, but this is a nice way to kind of hang the history and how, in the context of the music and vice versa. Like, how does one affect the other? How does one reflect the other?
Right. And so each of these songs, the essays aren't so much about, you know, what happens to the chord progression the second time around as it is what were the guys doing at this point in their lives and careers.
It's a little bit of both, actually. I mean, I didn't want to geek out too much being a musician that spent 25 years in the studio, 26 years in the studio, but I did want to share a little bit of what that experience is like, you know, to be in the studio. And, you know, oftentimes we're, the producers and the musicians are just kind of riffing about how bands like the Stones and the Beatles or whoever else got these classic sounds. And I do kind of spend a lot of time talking about the music and what makes this a great song. But I also do kind of get into what was going on in their lives and how these tracks might tell the story.
So let's take an example, the Stray Cat Blues. Now, you divide the book into three eras for the three guitarists other than Keith Richards, Brian Jones era, Mick Taylor era, and the Ron Wood era. So Brian Jones first. Stray Cat Blues, you call this catnip for those folks in 1968 who were outraged about the group's attitude towards women.
Yeah, I mean, they really doubled it down on this record. I mean, you know, they had kind of come out of that blues sort of macho poser thing that they were going through and become pop stars, you know, with Satisfaction Onward.
Get no.
then they kind of went into a little bit into the hippie-dom stuff with, you know, they got a little fey with, you know, Satanic Majesties is a great record that's sort of underrated, but they kind of went off into different directions of psychedelia and other influences. Then they had the famous 1967 busts. They took the first year off the road that they had taken since they started. And they really looked like they could have been down and out for the count right there. But they came roaring back with First Jumping Jack Flash as a single. Watch it! And then the really kind of seedy and dark and kind of... I guess what Grail Marcus would call the old weird America type of record with Beggar's Banquet, which has a lot of Appalachian, a lot of blues.
Waiting for a girl who's got curls in her hair. Waiting for a girl, she's no money anywhere. We get busted everywhere. Waiting for a back to girl.
And you know what they did is they sort of doubled down on the sort of blues history that they came from, but really kind of brought it to a contemporary context, so that you hear literally the Velvet Underground's influence on this song.
Right.
You can hear the opening kind of cadence of Heroin, the Velvet Underground song.
Yeah. And Brian Jones' influence, not in the guitar parts here, right?
Yeah, no, Brian on this track, I think, primarily comes through with a weird kind of mellotron part at the end. So you do have a little bit of that psychedelia floating through the kind of fluty sounds near the end as it dissipates into this kind of even weird, odd kind of seediness at the end.
Let's hear a little bit of the song that Bill Janovitz is talking about, one of the 50 songs he talks about in his new book, Rocks Off, Telling the Story of the Rolling Stones. The song is Stray Cat Blues from the Rolling Stones' 1968 record Beggar's Banquet, one of the 50 tracks that Bill Janovitz chose to write about in the book Rocks Off, 50 tracks that tell the story of the Rolling Stones. So what does this song tell us about the story of the Stones?
It really tells us that they're getting back to their roots, but also kind of keeping it up to date. You know, that I think they found a contemporary home for the blues that wasn't just some sort of period piece. Like, it was a way of forwarding the message of what was going on then. And it speaks a little bit of urban decay. I mean, clearly it's sort of a pimp-esque. I always heard that song as a rock star talking to a groupie, and I think that certainly is in it. And they're playing up that big bad wolf routine, but I think it's got a little bit of that sort of pre-Taxi Driver type of look at a pimp's relationship with a young hooker.
You know, I mean, I've heard that song so many times. I still don't know what he's saying for most of it. You know, that's why the idea that people would listen to this song in 1968 and immediately be outraged is like, really? How do you know what he's saying?
I don't think they were, because I think it was kind of buried in the album. You know, not even casual Stones fans really know much about this. I mean, it's on Get Your Ya-Ya's Out as a live version too, which is even kind of more rock and roll, but. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty. It's definitely a come on. I can hear you. He says, "I know you're just 16 years old, and you know I don't want your ID." And it's
Well, of course, you know, there's, as you mentioned in the book, there are many, many songs about 16-year-old girls that predate the Rolling Stones.
I think I said how many rock and roll songs from the 50s are not about teenage girls.
Really? So, Bill, how did you choose the 50 songs?
Well, you know, I really wanted to, you know, obviously get a lot of my favorites in there, if not all of them. And I couldn't get all of them. For example, on Goat's Head Soup, Angie is not one of my favorite songs anymore. Mm-hmm. It might have been when I was a kid. But, I mean, I would have gladly have included a song like Winter, which is kind of an unheralded... It's sort of a Stones fans Stones song. It's a beautiful song, but it doesn't really forward the narrative very much as much as Angie does. Primarily, Angie was about them staying relevant and to the extent that they had another worldwide hit after being sort of written off yet again, and where Keith was really slipping into bad drug use by his own admission.
Angie, Angie, when will those clouds all disappear? Angie, Angie, where will it lead us from here?
You know, so here it was, kind of them reclaiming the top of the charts again. So, you know, and then I really wanted to pay attention all the way throughout the whole career. I mean, here's a band that part of the main part of the Stone story is that they really were survivors and kept putting out new music, you know, right into, the early 2000s. So I really wanted to give every record its due. So there's at least one song from every album.
All right. So we're speaking with Bill Janovitz, author of this new book called Rocks Off, also a member of the band Buffalo Tom, with us on Soundcheck. And actually coming to play, you're doing some shows as Bill Janovitz, not as Buffalo Tom, right, here in New York.
That's right.
Friday at Spike Hill in Brooklyn, Saturday at Rockwood Music Hall, Stage 3, and then Sunday, a Stones review at the LIC Bar in LIC, Long Island City in Queens.
That's right. Yeah, a bunch of people playing Stones songs.
So you mentioned that your first Stones book was for that 33 and a third series, which is like, for people who haven't seen it, they're small paperback books about a single record, and you did Exile on Main Street. And the song we're going to hear next is the one that, it comes from Exile, and it's the one that gives you the title of this new book, Rocks Off. What is it about this song that stood out for you?
Well, this is kind of the classic great opening track from an album, and it really kind of tells the story, or at least a big part of the story, of Exile on Main Street, which is really divided up into, you know, the double record divided up into four sides, and they're not really balanced. I mean, each side is, you know, like the first side one is just all balls to the wall rock and roll, you know,
right.
And it starts off with this track, and it's the classic opening salvo, and it's got all the things that you think of as being great early 70s. It's got that groove. It's got those chugging rhythm guitars. It's got a horn part. And it's Mick really singing with the sort of conviction that he sort of eventually kind of lost, I think, as they waded into the 80s.
So, and this is from the second of the three eras. Brian Jones is dead by this point. Mick Taylor is the second guitarist in the Rolling Stones. Let's hear Rocks Off from Exile on Main Street. Song is Rocks Off from the Rolling Stones album Exile on Main Street, two record set that they released in 1972, and one of the 50 tracks in Bill Janovitz's new book called Rocks Off, 50 tracks that tell the story of the Rolling Stones. So what is this song and Exile on Main Street in general, what does this tell us about the story of the Stones?
Well, this is an interesting. I mean, you know, they've struggled with Exile over the years. I mean, Mick is all about the present or the future. Keith, you know, some people say this is Keith's record. Some people say that's. I mean, clearly, Tattoo U is Mick's record. He saved the band yet another time, putting that one together from old outtakes. But coming back a little bit further, close to this one in time, Goat's Head Soup was more of Mick's record. I think he was kind of the driving force with a lot of ballads there and. Some funk influence there. But this is really, I mean, Exile on Main Street is, I said in the Exile book, it's kind of the perfect distillation of all the essential components of roots and rock and country music. You know, what made rock and roll great to begin with up to the 1970s? You know, it's kind of a little bit of a punk rock record as well. I mean, you could hear that Mick was very conscious of the Stooges and Velvets. And I mean, that stuff was all there. A little bit of glam rock maybe even, but it's kind of a retro record. But it still feels very much new, and it really kind of, you know, with Tumbling Dice and songs like that, Let It Loose, the gospel influence. I mean, it's just it's sort of the last real big sort of bluesy gospel record that they did, you know?
So that's the second of the three eras. There's the Brian Jones era first, Mick Taylor second, and then Mick Taylor leaves the band and is replaced by Ron Wood, and that is the era of the Rolling Stones that you admit, I think it's at the beginning of the book, to having the most difficult time with. I mean, you wanted to represent it, but let's face it, some of the records were, well, you damn them with faint praise.
Well, I mean, I don't want to say that it's the Ron Wood years, just the Ron Wood years, because I mean, I think Ron Wood, he's sort of an underrated figure in the Stones history, and I mean, he really comes out of the Faces. He was, you know, kind of like family to the Stones, and he really kind of gave them a kick in the ass. He came in at the tail end of Black and Blue, but you know, the next record was Some Girls, and
right, which
that's
was
them
a,
really,
yeah, a return to form for the band.
Absolutely, yeah, and he's really one of the driving forces on that. And then they had personal difficulties, and they couldn't pull another record together, so they went back to the outtakes and put together Tattoo U. And then after Tattoo U, you know, arguably, you know, they had definitely found, I think, their last peak, and it was a matter of scraping it together and trying to stay current all the time with Mick, seemed to be Mick's, you know, forced, right? Trying to keep them commercially relevant. And, you know, so I do feel like they found their footing on some later records as well. But, you know, to me, the 80s records in particular, like Undercover and that kind of stuff. And I know there are some diehards that love that stuff. I mean, you know, it's hard for me to love some of that stuff.
In talking about our next song, Out of Tears, from the 1993 record Voodoo Lounge, you say the Stones continued to come up with some genuinely good songs.
Yeah, and, you know,
I mean, that's not the most enthusiastic imprimatur I've ever read, Bill, but all right, so how good is this song?
Well, this is a really good song. I mean, you know, it's kind of, it really could have been on some of their early, mid-70s records. It's definitely a kind of plaintive ballad, and it's Mick just kind of picking out the notes on the piano. That's how it was written. But this one's got this. I think it's the first one with Daryl Jones on bass, or in the book, maybe. So it's a different era for the song. And Chuck Lavelle, who had been with the Allman Brothers, is now a keyboard player for them. And I think even Benmont Tench from the Heartbreakers is Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers is playing a little organ on this track.
Out of Tears is the name of the song from the Rolling Stones' Voodoo Lounge.
I can't feel a thing. I can't shout, I can't scream, breathe it out, breathe it in, all this love from within.
From the album Voodoo Lounge, 1993 record from the Rolling Stones, that is Out of Tears, one of 50 tracks that Bill Janovitz chose to write about in his new book, Rocks Off, 50 tracks that tell the story of the Rolling Stones. And so what part of the story are we getting here?
Well, now I think it's the Stones just sort of wrestling with their legacy, and I think coming to terms with it ultimately. You know, for all the interviews that Mick gave, saying sort of, you know, we're done with the past. Let's try to sound something, you know, bring something new. What's the point, essentially? And it's a valid point. I think that you also have to say, well, look, I mean, you know, here's all this great history you've built. Here's this sound you guys built. You kind of stay within your wheelhouse to some extent. And to hear Daryl Jones bringing, I mean, you know, even having been in a band all these years since I'm whatever 12 years old. I don't know if I ever gave the bass player that much of a credit because, you know, it's just a different sound. Daryl plays differently than Bill
than
would.
Bill Wyman,
Bill Wyman would probably play the notes a little bit more staccato maybe, or I don't know. There was a bit more of a swing. He's an older school. But Daryl comes in with sort of a beefier sort of almost steady low end. And it's just a little different. I mean, I think it brings a different flavor to the Stones.
As your book does, to the oft-told tale of the Stones. Instead of giving us more chapter and verse history of Mick and Keith and the gang, Bill Janovitz gives us 50 tracks that tell the story of the Rolling Stones. The book is called Rocks Off. Bill's here in town performing Friday night at Spike Hill in Brooklyn, Saturday at the Rockwood Music Hall on Stage 3, and Sunday a Stones review with friends at the LIC Bar in Long Island City. Bill, it's been great going through some of these 50 tracks with you today. Thanks very much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yesterday on Soundcheck, we talked with Aylin Zafar about her recent BuzzFeed article called What It's Like When a Label Won't Release Your Album. We talked about the singer JoJo and other artists whose records have remained unreleased by their record labels. Well, we got a call from a listener who asked to remain anonymous. She works in an A&R department at a major label and wanted to weigh in.
The fact of the matter is that a lot of times records don't get put out on time because artists do not give us their proper information, such as producer agreements, publisher splits, sample clearances, side artist clearances. To get an album put out, there are a lot of little parts that are in motion, and it's not just about the label saying, this isn't exactly what we wanted. Let's put this on the shelf until the right moment comes along. That's not how it works. And I kind of resent the fact that this person is saying that we purposely shelve things, which, you know, we do, but not all the time. You know, a lot of the albums that you mentioned didn't come out for very specific reasons, and a lot of it had to do with the artist supplying us with the information that we needed and able to release those albums. And I just wanted to kind of put my two cents in there. Thanks. Bye.
That's a Soundcheck listener who's also a staffer at a major record label talking about our segment yesterday about artists who make records for major labels and then the labels choose not to release them. You can hear the segment on our website, soundcheck.org, or on our podcast on iTunes. And we're always glad to hear what you think about what you hear on the show. You can leave us a message, 866-939-1612, or email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org. Coming up, the British post-punk band Savages had no trouble getting their debut album released. It is getting serious attention, and they'll play live for us next. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Last year, the British post-punk band Savages was being hailed as one of the best new bands in the UK, and they only had one or two songs to their credit at that point. During last year's CMJ Music Festival here in New York, we were one of many singing their praises as well. Now that band's debut, called Silence Yourself, is out, and the reviews are in, and they are raves. We have really been looking forward to having the band here in the Soundcheck studio with us for some time, and they are here with us today. Starting off with a song called Cities Full, here is Savages live on Soundcheck. The band Savages, live on Soundcheck with a song called Cities Full. You'll find it on their debut album called Silence Yourself, but that's a live performance. Jenny Beth singing, Gemma Thompson playing guitar, Aisha Hassan playing the bass, and Faye Milton on drums. Jenny and Gemma joining me at the microphones.
Hello.
Guys, thank you so much
Hello.
For being here. A boring first question would be, how did your band get formed? But the striking thing about it is you guys came out of the box like fully formed. You seem to have such a clear kind of vision of who Savages were going to be. How did that happen so fast?
Well, we've all been playing music for years, really, in different formations. Aisha and myself have been playing music for about 5 years together. And I played in John and Jen and toured with them.
Which was, Jenny, your old band.
Not that old.
Previous band, I should say.
Each of us have a different background in music, but also together. So Faye Milton has a background in worldwide percussion. So we kind of took all the experiences we had and wanted to make something that was straight away an impact and focus on certain elements like the actual performance,
mm-hmm.
And just keep it simple, pared down, and try and find the first elements that we enjoy about the music we make, which is why the name Savages was quite fitting.
So it's more about being elemental than being literally savage.
Yeah, intent, I suppose.
Yeah.
Intent behind what you're doing.
Well, you know, one of the things that happened, of course, was, you know, you did this opening gig for British Sea Power, mm. and then, you know, you had a couple of songs, and then people just started... A pretty prominent British critic proclaimed you guys the best new band in the UK... very early on. Jenny, was there kind of a weight of expectation when it came time to actually make a full-length record?
No, I think we toured the songs for like a year, and then before we started thinking about recording, when we wrote the first songs, we never thought about recording in the first place. The songs were written with the idea of a performance behind it. What mattered to us is to think what kind of emotions this sound is creating, what is shape everything around the show, around a live, exciting thing.
So you think of yourselves as a live band first.
Yeah, that was the old intent we had at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
and. To set ourselves different kind of goals and trying to achieve them with each song and trying to be quite thoughtful about what we were trying to achieve and then trying them out on stage. And
well, now there is, as you say, a kind of a thoughtful quality to a lot of what you do. I mean, people who check out your website will see that you've written a number of things. For example, Silence Yourself, the title of the album. You back that up in live performance recently by asking audiences to turn off their phones so that you're not playing to a sea of little blue screens.
Yeah, but that seemed really common sense to us. I don't, it's just, I think people are dying for these kind of things to stop from happening, but it's easier to do it in a group than, to think of it on your own. So it's just giving a bit, some kind of guidance or ideas that we... things we prefer to do, or
is there an irony to the title Silence Yourself when this music is, I mean, this is not background music, this is not for a quiet evening at home, this is loud, in your face, upfront music.
Yeah, that was intentional, playing to be played in the foreground.
Yeah, I mean, you can take that title numerous ways, but I suppose our main idea was to achieve a kind of focus. To kind of focus what you're trying to do, whether you're the viewer, the listener, or the performer, and to share that idea of focus is kind of the goal, I suppose.
And something that seems to have been, I mean, if anything has been lost, I'm not one of these people who says, oh, digital bad, analog, old days great. But one thing that I've noticed, I mean, it's happened to me as well, is. The time that you spend actually just like shutting everything else out just to focus on the music that's in front of you, that is something. And the idea of focus and including your audience as kind of an active part of your concert, that idea seems, it's an old-fashioned idea, but it seems kind of revolutionary again.
Yeah. I suppose there are so many distractions.
Yeah.
All right. I think it's also the idea of when you're stepping out of the world and you remain silent for a while, it can already be seen as an act of resistance, and in itself, you know, you don't necessarily need to react to everything all mm-hmm. the time.
So how does the songwriting in Savages happen? Gemma, does Jenny come to you with a set of lyrics already done and then you write music around, or is it vice versa?
We don't really have any set way in terms of how they begin, like the actual thing that they begin with. But we do have a very similar process for each song, I suppose. It's about finding, trying to be quite minimal, trying to find something that works and not being afraid to repeat that, to try and drop anything that we don't think is necessary. And then to finish writing the songs during the performance, to actually let that performance finish shaping them. And maybe so they change each time we perform them sometimes, just mm-hmm. until they become a finished thing.
So there's a lot of repetition, Jenny, in the lyrics as there is in the music.
I like repetition. I like to find an intensity with repetition, how a word can be repeated several times and it changes its meaning. Instead of writing choruses with different kind of lines, just repeated in the same way.
If you've been following this band, you know that their first song, the one that really sort of grabbed a lot of ears on both sides of the Atlantic, was a song called Husbands. That's what they're going to play for us next. Once again, Savages, performing Thursday, September 12th at Terminal 5 here in New York, and playing Husbands for us live on Soundcheck. Savages with a live performance of their song Husbands here in the Soundcheck studio. Jenny Beth singing, Gemma Thompson playing guitar, Faye Milton on drums, Aisha Hassan playing the bass. Jenny, are these songs like character studies? I mean, did you have some person in mind when you wrote the lyrics for Husbands?
Not for Husbands, but some songs I do, yeah, of course. But it's more like a mix of different things. You may start with someone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, She Will was definitely from a friend of mine called Nina, who had a particular ability to enjoy life.
Mm.
And I found that really beautiful, and I wanted to write something about that. But then a different kind of, loads of characters kind of went in afterwards. It was a mix of different things.
Okay. The only reason I ask about that song in particular is the plural. You know, it's my house, my bed, my husband's. It's like,
I know,
how many does she have?
Well,
and are they all at once, or have they been consecutive?
Well, I like it plural.
It certainly, it certainly adds a little frisson to the song. Gemma, there's an instrumental track on the record called Dead Nature, which has maybe an echo of the old industrial musical sound of the 80s. Is that kind of one of the musical threads that goes into this band?
Oh, completely, yeah. We're very interested in, kind of instrument-wise, in how you play your instrument and the purpose behind what you're playing on it. And it doesn't have to be the right technical way to play it. So there's late 70s New York No Way, for instance, when you would approach your instruments as though it was something completely different, or you would try and work out, how can I get this sound out of this? You know, it doesn't have to be the right way to do things.
Right.
And when we were recording the album, we set up the studio so that we could explore anything we wanted within kind of the confines of the instruments we played and wrote the songs on. And so we hung a guitar and we had this kind of sound going on. So it was a real kind of physical way to play it.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Jim, I always had this ability to see sound first with an instrument, especially with guitar. When we kind of discovered her when she was playing in, different bands in a project in London, myself and Johnny Hostile, and then there was these videos of her like playing noise guitar more than guitar. That was
more noise,
right,
more
right.
than guitar,
more noise than chords. But that's definitely a great approach. You know?
Well, and the no wave movement here in New York, a lot of those musicians, quote unquote, were actually filmmakers and sculptors. It was, part of the whole deal was you did something in a different medium from the one you were supposedly expert in.
Yeah.
Now, there is the album's closing track called Marshall Deer has a solo that a lot of people think is a saxophone, but it's got to be either a clarinet or even a bass clarinet. Which is it?
It's a clarinet.
Yeah.
It's a clarinet. Who is... It's a really neat sound. Mm.
It is an avant-gardist blues musician called Duke Garwood.
Garwood. He did that record with Mark Lanegan.
Exactly, Black Pudding.
Black Pudding, right.
Yeah. Just been released a few months ago on Heavenly Records. Duke is someone I've met with Johnny Hostile a few years ago when he was playing in London. He's very unknown, but he's preparing a new record at the moment, and this record with Mark Lanegan. I mean, he's been touring with C6T, Mark Lanegan, for years, and he's incredible guitar player and singer.
And apparently clarinetist.
And yeah, he's a multi-instrumentist. It was a pleasure to have him come around in the studio, and he did this little punk clarinet solo, as he says.
Neat.
It
sounds like a saxophone at first, and then he hits those low notes, and he's like, no, that's no saxophone. We've been listening to the band Savages. We'll hear a little bit of this song, Marshall Deer, to wrap up, but the band Savages, the album is called Silence Yourself. We are all huge fans here at Soundcheck, and this has been great having the four of you performing for
Thank
us.
You.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
This is Soundcheck. Up next, a recording archive at Columbia University is returning songs to the Native Americans who recorded them many decades ago. A musicologist joins us to explain next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. If you've been following the news lately, you've probably seen photos of Cambodian statues, Etruscan pottery, Turkish mosaics, Greek urns, all accompanied by stories of museums being asked to return these artworks to their countries of origin. It's become a pretty big deal in the art world, and some of these repatriation stories can get pretty contentious. But Columbia University's Center for Ethnomusicology is voluntarily returning to several Native American groups a treasure trove of rare recordings of traditional songs and dances. Aaron Fox, Associate Professor of Music at Columbia, is former director and currently the archivist at the center. Aaron, hi.
Hi, John.
So did the Hopi, we were hearing a Hopi song just a moment ago, did the Hopi, the Navajo, the Inupiaq from Alaska, did they request that you guys return this? Or did you just think, hey, you know what, we should do the right thing here?
Boy, it's a very long story that starts with a Navajo family in Albuquerque, New Mexico, gathering for a family funeral. One of the daughters of this family was a young woman named Nanaba Becker, who has gone on to become a well-known Navajo filmmaker. But at the time, she was an MFA student in film at Columbia University. She returned home for the funeral of her grandmother. Her sister, who was coming from Chicago, had picked up a record called Navajo Songs, which was released in 92 by Smithsonian Folkways Records. And which featured a set of tracks from recordings made by the collector Laura Bolton at something called the Century of Progress Exposition in Chicago in 1933. I know it's a long story.
So the Smithsonian Folkways recording included some of the material that's
correct
in the Columbia archive.
Right, by permission. And actually, in fact, I believe there a payment had actually transacted between the Smithsonian Folkways Records and Columbia University, although this was before my time in the early 90s, and subsidized and supported by the Grateful Dead's drummer Mickey Hart, who sought to produce beautiful audio so that these recordings would, you know, sparkle.
Mm-hmm. And so everybody should be happy.
Everybody should be happy. And in fact, there's a very happy story that follows from this. So despite it being a funeral, Nanaba's sister brought this record, at which point the girl's mother said, I hear my father and grandfather on that record. And it turned out that she was exactly right. The record featured an elder Navajo medicine man, elder in 1933, named Pablo Huelito, and his sons. And these were, in fact, Nanaba Becker's great-grandfather and grandfather, among other relatives, on this record. So as they said, and they Googled Laura Bolton, whose name appeared in the notes to the collection, along with a credit to Columbia University. And since Nanaba was a student, they sent Nanaba, you know, in pursuit of her great-grandfather's recordings.
Wow.
And irony of ironies, she actually worked in the building where the tape copies of these recordings are stored, which is Dodge Hall on the Columbia campus. That's where it all started.
So this Pablo and Frank Huelito, this moccasin game song, is an example of what they heard and recognize
correct
the voices as being members of their own family.
Absolutely. And that's a process
wow
that since then, this was in 2002, 2003, since then I've seen replicated a dozen times. The first hearing of one's great-grandfather or one's grandfather over, you know, 60, 70, 80-year-old recording is a very powerful thing to see.
So this is a recording from the 1930s that's in Columbia University's Center for Ethnomusicology archives and being returned to the Navajo people. So that is some traditional Navajo singing, a moccasin game song, one of two recorded in 1933, did you say, Aaron?
1933 in Chicago, not in Ojo Encino, New Mexico, where these
So it was an exhibition where the collector, Laura Bolton, made
right.
the recording.
It was like a World's Fair, and they brought several dozen representatives of several dozen Indian tribes to perform for a year for tourists. And a number of anthropologists and collectors showed up to conveniently document a lot of Native American culture in one place.
We're speaking with Aaron Fox, who is a curator of the Center for Ethnomusicology at Columbia, which is voluntarily returning to the Navajo, to the Hopi, to the Inupiaq in Alaska, this treasure trove, as right. I said before, of recordings. You give anthropologists a chance to meet somebody who's a speaker of a dying language or a dying culture, and the first thing they're going to want to do is stick a microphone in front of that person right. and capture all the songs and stories they can get. So,
correct. However, this was all the rage, of course, in the middle of the 20th century, and any number of collectors and scholars set about documenting what they perceived to be dying languages and cultures. And in most cases, those presumptions were quite wrong. And so, you know, take something like Alaskan Eskimo Dance, which Laura Bolton recorded in 1946, and which is my primary project myself, working with the Inupiaq people. She believed, as did her Inupiaq consultants, I think, that the music she was documenting was in serious trouble in 1946. It couldn't be healthier now.
Really?
It's explosively important to the performance of Eskimo Inupiaq identity in Alaska and more broadly around the world. Virtually every young person in Alaska's North Slope participates in dance, traditional dance. And so she, in effect, was wrong.
Happily
wrong. But the assumptions that were built into that salvage ethnography included the presumption that the collector was acting in the best interests of posterity and the future, and therefore could ride roughshod over the interests, even the expressed interests of the communities and the performers and the individuals whom he or she was documenting. And that's left us, as curators of these collections, in an awkward position, given that we have been utterly dependent on knowledge gained from studying these recordings and working to collect these recordings. So under any terms of ethics, we owe a reciprocal obligation then to return not only the materials and the rights, but to add value in the act of return in some way, to do something in gratitude for having had access to these materials.
Now, let me ask you what that means in just a moment, but I want to play one of these Inupiaq songs, an untitled dance song. Now, these people knew they were being recorded, so there was nothing. This was
correct.
Freely done,
not surreptitious recording.
Okay,
staged, in fact.
Do you know where is this? Like up north Alaska?
Oh, it's a place I spend a lot of my time. It's in a place called Barrow, Alaska, which is the northernmost community in the United States.
From the proverbial recording. Frozen north, an untitled dance song from the Inupiaq people. A traditional Inupiaq song from Barrow, Alaska, recorded in 1946, part of the archives at Columbia University's Center for Ethnomusicology. And as Aaron Fox, their curator, is telling us, these songs now being repatriated back to the Inupiaq in the north, to the Hopi and the Navajo in the southwest. And you said something about not just giving them back the tapes, but adding some value to it. How
right.
do you do that? What do you mean by that?
Well, so it's my argument that to the extent Native communities and artists gave freely of their creative work to people like Laura Bolton, who collected this music, or Alan Lomax, or any of the other famous collectors of our, you know, previous century, they did so in the expectation, reasonable expectation of reciprocity.
But what does reciprocity in this case mean? Does this
correct.
Mean we're going to give them our songs? Or?
Well, of course, we've done plenty of that. And in some ways, you know, the imbalance in access to media and so forth has you know, been of great concern in that our songs sometimes seem like they're going to drown out their songs, although we've really moved past that in the current generation. And just to, so I'll give you a very quick example of what adding value means. The collector who recorded these songs, the one you just heard, and about 115 others on her eight-day trip to Barrow in 1946, did not speak Inupiaq, spent a week in town, had minimal contact after that with the community or the, you know, the culture. And so with National Science Foundation funding, my collaborator, Chia Sakakibara, who's a geographer at Oklahoma, University of Oklahoma, and myself have spent a number of years redocumenting this collection by listening to it systematically with the leading elder experts on Inupiaq traditional music in the Inupiaq community. We're able to produce an oral historical account of the recordings that provides a far, far richer historical account of what they are and what the songs are about and who the performers were and what they meant at the time.
You're giving them context and you're giving the Inupiaq people the chance to have what that Navajo family had, the chance to say, I know that voice. I remember that person.
I see it happen in Alaska all the time.
That's really neat. All right. A lot of the Hopi stuff is being repatriated.
Right.
And I want to wrap up with a Hopi lullaby that kind of goes to an interesting point that we've sort of talked around but not actually discussed yet. And that is, if these people thought that they were documenting a dying language 70 or 80 years ago and the language is not dead, and now you come with this truckload of, you know, tapes of songs from 70, 80 years ago, has the Hopi language changed significantly or significantly enough in the 70 or 80 years that people are like, oh, I forgot we used to speak like that?
Yes, very often that's the case. I mean, I don't want to say that many of these indigenous languages are not endangered. But yes, in 70 years, every English changes. Think about movies that are 70 years old and how differently people speak in them now. And imagine that if we didn't have, you know, a community, if only our elders spoke English anymore, and there were very few of them left who spoke it fluently, and all of a sudden you had a Clark Gable movie, you know, you might have to listen through some anachronisms, you know, in order to capture the grammar and the meaning of the language. But also it changes, and it's expected to change, and nobody wants it to stay the same. But at the same time, it's important to have the materials that document its history since contact.
So just quickly before I let you go, Aaron, how long will this repatriation project take?
Well, one of the arguments of the whole enterprise here is, in fact, that this is not a transaction but a relationship. And so the answer is as long as possible. We really are hoping that what we're doing here is rebuilding connections between ethnomusicology and indigenous communities across which people can walk in both directions in perpetuity.
That's a good answer. All right. Aaron Fox, the curator of Columbia University's Center for Ethnomusicology. They are in the process of returning to the Inupiaq in Alaska and the Hopi in the Southwest and the Navajo as well. All of these great old recordings of traditional songs and dances, including this stink bug lullaby that we'll end with. Aaron, thanks very much for being with us.
You bet. Thank you, John. My pleasure.
Tomorrow on the show, music has played a pivotal role in the work of writer Chuck Klosterman, who wrote about hair metal in his first book, Fargo Rock City. He joins us to talk about villains of the musical and non-musical variety, as discussed in his new book, I Wear the Black Hat. Plus, behind the new Shakespeare in the Park production of Love's Labor's Lost, and a live performance from the Scottish art pop band Franz Ferdinand. That'll do it for today. See you tomorrow at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.